Welcome to the Kofkin Bond podcast. Today our guest is Agostino Giramondo. Celebrating 30 years in the media and publishing industry, Agostino has been a member of the executive leadership teams at the Herald and Weekly Times, Nationwide News, CarSales.com and Oz Cycling. Here's what you refer to as an early adopter of the convergence of media and the acceptance that all publishers are digital media companies. He is an advocate for the working together model, an approach he has adopted throughout his career and indeed his life. He believes it is the only way to make a positive difference professionally and personally. He considers himself fortunate to have worked with clear-thinking decision makers and business partners who have played a role in developing his leadership mantra of establishing priorities and making the decisions to deliver them. Ag is a subscriber to the motto that we must change before we have to and is recognized as a change agent. Enjoy.
Agostino Giramondo, welcome, my friend of probably 42 odd years, most likely. We were in year seven at St. Bernard's together when we first met. Welcome to the Kofkin Bond podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's an honour. I'm really excited. Yeah, long time listener. And finally, you must be scraping the bottom of the barrel, but you got me on as a guest. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. When we caught up for lunch, I said, I'm paying for lunch, but as a result of this, you will be a podcast guest of mine. So it's now we have got you on here for a reason, not just we're not going to reminisce about the last 42 years of life after school, but I've actually asked you on here because you actually in some way, and this is how I would like to describe it, a bit of an icon around Melbourne, the person that everyone knows but people wonder who you are, if that makes sense. And we're going to start off in respect to what I want to talk about, if we can, to start with, is a lot of people that we went to school with, probably 60% or more, I would suggest, were either immigrants or the firstborn of immigrants down in St. Bernard's, there in Moonee Ponds and Essendon, as you and I certainly were. And a lot of our parents came here to escape, the poverty of, after World War II and all tyranny in that respect. And, even the generation of migrants after us, say, being the Vietnamese, it was the same. They were obviously escaping war to come here. But we seem to have had this ingrained built into us. Our parents came here with nothing, worked hard, gave us an education, and as a result turned us and some of our colleagues into some of the best leaders and business owners and managing directors of large corporations, etc., around the country. Where do you think that stemmed from, and from your own personal experience as well?
I think you're right with the description. Coming from a war-torn country, escaping tyranny, and this is anywhere in the world, and it continues to today with immigration. Back then, World War II was a significant event. Those that study it understand how significant, and how in Europe in particular, there was lots of division. Even in Sicily, where my parents came from, the Sicilians were opposed to the mainland Italians. I read a fabulous book called Sicily 1943, which explained the Battle of Sicily, which helped turn World War II. That's when Hitler lost the support of Mussolini because Mussolini lost the support of all Italians. So you think about fleeing that type of environment, you can't bring up a family and you can't build a future. So it makes sense that you decide to start somewhere else, pull up stumps somewhere else. What I find remarkable is that they chose Australia, bottom of the earth. Maybe it's a postcard that you look at. I've heard some stories, I don't know if they're true, but people thought they were going to Austria, or family thought they were going to Austria. So they, don't worry, if it doesn't work out, you can come back, right? No, we're going to Australia, it's further away. So you think about getting on a boat, you think about the death rate on those boats, people didn't make it, the conditions, and then they arrive in Fremantle, and then you come across this Great Australian Bight, one of the worst crossings in the world, to get to Melbourne. And then you go off into the country. You end up in Mildura, Swan Hill, Cobram, or you end up in an area where a lot of your fellow Italians or Greeks or Irish or whatever settled. It could have been Werribee, or it could have been St Kilda, any of those places, depending on where you came from. So all of these experiences are new. So no wonder they're resilient, and no wonder we are. it makes sense. It's just been carried down. And we were brought up in a way, Tony, I know you were. We talk affectionately about our parents, particularly our fathers. I mean, these people were hardworking people.
Really
hard. They took some risks and some came off, some didn't, but they never considered the option of not going ahead. They'd made the decision. And once you make that decision, you go through with it.
It's interesting when you consider, say, your parents and my parents. And I remember my mum saying this. She said, although they faced racism, it was racism in a different sense. Even though mum had a very thick, still does have an Irish accent, being called a bloody pom, you know, which is quite offensive to an Irish person. So it's, she said the difference that we had was we could actually speak English. So from our perspective, we could still blend in that little bit more. Whereas when you had the Italians and the Greeks as well, who all came, and remember the White Australia policy only ended in 1966, mm-hmm. Even though we're all part of that, but it was that perspective where it was certainly, definitely very hard for a lot of migrants who English wasn't their first language.
So for mum, not so much. She came over when she was two. I remember a lot of people being surprised when they'd met my mum because she just had a full-on Aussie accent. They expected the old Italian woman's accent. But with Dad, he was 16. And there was definitely racism. You couldn't speak English. You get called all sorts of things. We know what they are.
Overseas guest.
Yeah, that's right. And the Dago and all those things. And again, they found jobs where there were more people that were like them. And then there were good people. There were good people who understood the value of immigrants and why it was important to embrace them. So I've always been of the opinion that good outweighs evil.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear about the negative ones, but you rarely hear about the people who went out of their way. And Dad would always talk about people who looked after him, you know. At the same time, it was very difficult. But the jobs they were doing weren't the best jobs either. So in some ways,
there's no unemployment benefits back then.
No, there were no benefits. I mean, and the hours were extraordinary and, you know, a lot of people came over and they still hadn't brought the rest of their family over. So, you know, it was one of those things where you probably go, well, okay, I might be getting called names and it might be tough, but it's still better than where I was. And so I'm just going to knuckle down. And I reckon it taught us. I mean, we were talking about this the other day, that I don't remember any tension between nationalities at school. None.
You either liked each other or you didn't.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with nationalities, et cetera.
It was more about if you're an Essendon supporter or a Richmond supporter.
So you had done a bit at St Bernard's, being a Tiger.
Yeah, done being a Tiger. It was a terrible time, but, you know, it's been better recently.
You had about three close friends and that was it. Yeah, a Tiger fan during winter.
Yep. I had to interview Kevin Sheedy every week during the school captain year and that hurt. He was still a Richmond player to me. It was only 3 years before that he was at Richmond. So, but my point is that, you know, they have taught us to be part of the community. Dad made a big effort to, whilst he was in Italian clubs, but he also joined the East Killer Rotary Club, for example.
Yeah.
So it depends on the individual too.
Yeah.
You know, some actually did stay in their little groups and it took some time to get out and it was the kids that did it. But for others, I was brought up in an environment where Dad would say, if you're ever going to play sport for a country, it's Australia. If you're going to represent politics, it's in Australian politics, you're an Australian citizen. So you're an Australian. Yeah. So we're never brought up with this identity crisis. I think as I got older, I appreciated my Italian background more and more. I never didn't, but I appreciated it more, and I'm quite proud to say that I come from an Italian background, and the food in Italy and the way we do things and all that sort of thing is cool. But I was definitely and still am an Australian, and that's because of Dad.
It's interesting, you remember our year 9, year 10 Italian teacher, Bruno Spiller. Wonderful, wonderful guy, Mr. Spiller. I did run into Bruno up in Harrodville, and he was living up there doing his Italian tours, but it's a great, great distance runner as well, long distance runner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember he was always quite surprised at how good my Italian homework was compared to my class participation. And that might have had something to do with Mrs. Natale around the corner helping me out quite a bit with the Italian homework. But if we move on, you know, Agostino, you were actually our school captain and you did have those leadership qualities from a very young age. And you have a look at some of the people at our reunion and you go back to when they were at school and you can see where they are today. was actually in them as a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old, you saw you as a leader. Now, Kyle Tyrrell, a mutual friend of ours, he was always going to be in the Army and he was always going to have that as a career, not just – and he did make a real career out of it as well. But you had those leadership qualities from a very young age. You also had – you were good academically as well. And you were always a great speaker. And then you went and joined the media industry.
Yes.
You actually did MC as a youngster, as a young fella, at Italian weddings, I believe.
Yes.
But you've spent 30 years in media and publishing industry. Where did that all start? How did that start?
Well, you go back to the leadership stuff. I mean, I don't think a person ever sees themselves as I am a leader, but there was...
You are a leader at the moment at News Corp.
Yeah.
And you spent a career there at News Corp as well.
25 of the 30 years has been in leadership positions.
Yeah.
And that's been great.
Yeah.
Just the learnings. But if you go back to the school time, you know, Kyle and I actually did a camp with St. Kevin's, a leadership camp. There were only four of us from St. Bernard's that were chosen. Now, it was Kyle and I and another two. I'm sorry, I don't remember the other two. But we were plucked out and we had to do some orienteering through Mount Stirling and climb the crosscut saw, and we had food rations and had to fend for ourselves, and that was unbelievable, right? And I saw Kyle in his element there. I'm not surprised that Kyle has had the career he's
happy
had.
To have him on your team.
Very happy to have him on the team, and you know he's doing outstanding things now. So I think I got into the media industry quite by accident, really. You know, I'd finished it at Swinburne, Bachelor of Applied Science. My parents had a business. I went into that. That business collapsed. And I found myself not wanting to do what I'd studied, really loving business and the opportunity to go in business, but really quite timid about joining business. So I worked for almost 2 years in a restaurant, and I owe a man called Dominic Spinella a great deal of gratitude for taking me in. He had a restaurant, and all he could offer me was a job in the kitchen. And he didn't want to. And I said, well, if you don't, I'll go down to Mooney Ponds Pizza or somewhere else and get a job. And, you know, I was obviously friends with his son, Phil.
Carosello's
one of those. But he was great, gave me a great leg up. And I worked really hard, double shifts. And I applied for jobs, but I couldn't get one. A mate of mine, or he was a mate of mine and still is, a guy called Ralph Brannacci, was working at Leader Newspapers. And he said, look, you should apply for a job with us. And I reckon you could sell. Right, and Leader was a paper that we used in the travel agency. So we'd put an ad on the front page of the Essendon Gazette, Hamilton Island, $8.99, and you knew it worked because people would come in when that paper came out. So I understood advertising works, but yeah, it took a while to get in. I had an interview, didn't get anywhere. Then I interviewed for another job, didn't get anywhere. Interviewed for a third job, which was as a real estate account manager. And it took me 3 interviews in that one to finally get it. So I think there was no one else left, and I got the job. It's a bit funny now because that particular person that made it difficult for me did confess later and say, hey, I don't know what I didn't see. But I had no references. I had a family business that had collapsed as a referee. I hadn't worked, so I don't blame people. I have learned from that, though, that I actually make decisions on who you employ, not on their CV but on character traits and their attitude. So that's where it started. I got a job as an account manager selling real estate advertising to real estate agents out of the Northcote office of Leader Newspapers in 1994 for the Coburg Courier and the Brunswick Sentinel.
So in your early 20s at this stage?
24, 25, yeah.
First news article ever done on me with a photo was in the Essendon Gazette. Oh. I was a 19-year-old triathlete travelling the world.
Yeah,
and Mrs. Carey from St. Bernard's had that framed in the Hall of Fame. I was in shock about it.
But that's the thing, is that, you know, like today it's hard. You might share an article. The power of having that story appear, it's a timestamp. You know, it's a record of history. And who doesn't have newspaper clippings?
My mum still does of the odd one.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, you did a few, so.
You're in the news, you're in the media industry now. Mm. So the media industry was far different 30 years ago, but what are some of those earliest memories that you actually have? And who were some of your earlier inspirations as well?
Yeah, my earliest memories were that you look back now, and it was a really archaic process, but you had a group of clients and you go out and see them. Real estate was a bit different to other advertising. They advertised every week, so you weren't really selling too much. You had a consistent
thing. They had to advertise on the print media at that stage.
Yeah, yeah. There was nothing else to advertise. Or nowhere else to advertise. But it was big, you know, back pages. EJ Doherty had, you know, 10 pages in the Coburg Courier, and then you had your small ones like Walsh and Whitelock, et cetera. So all these agents, the routine would be that you'd go around and pick up their ads. And what I learned from that was that some were really organised. Some had all their ads ready. My now wife worked at EJ Doherty, and she was doing all the advertising. Every photo was marked, every, you know, A matches A photo with copy and all that sort of thing. Then you
is that how you met?
Yep. That's how we met.
She looked forward to seeing you every week. She had everything prepared.
I think I made her better, to be honest, yeah. She was terrific. But the contrast, you know, Tanina would be super organised, and then I'd go and see a person who's still a very good friend of mine, Rick Mbisi, at Walsh and Whitelock, one-man show. And I'd walk into his office late because I knew he'd be the last one ready. And he's still writing down the copy. Bagger, I'm not going to be long. You know, I go, Rick, no worries, let me help you. So I'd help him. I'd get back to the office and I'd miss the courier. You had to put all the ads in a bag that would go into a tray, and the courier would come and take them to Blackburn where the papers were printed. I missed the courier. Okay. My colleagues are like, Ag, you've got to train this guy. I didn't understand what that meant. One-man show. So I complete empathy for his situation. So I decided to just keep it late, and I would drive the ads myself down to Blackburn. And that gave me the opportunity to meet the people in production. And these are the same people who, if an ad went wrong, we would blame production, in inverted commas. Oh, it's the people at production. Why, I'd ask. Well, what did they do wrong? Oh, they were always mucking things up. But we didn't know why. We just said the story. So by going down there, I met a guy called Ray Kenner, who's no longer with us, but Ray was pretty much like, you're from advertising, what the hell do you want? You know, you never come here. I said, I want to find out what you do. So that experience of actually understanding what the process is when an ad comes in, what has to happen, we quickly worked out that some of the fonts we were recommending, for example, just weren't reproducing in newsprint properly. So the recommendation was really simple, back to the advertising agency or the client who was looking after that, or the client whose ad it was, just use a different font. And we had fewer and fewer complaints. So you learn to actually ask questions, I suppose, which is, you've got to have a curiosity. So I've got memories like that, and that were the 5 years that I was a rep before I went into a leadership role.
But sometimes with some people, you might have had a manager that just turned around and said, that's not your job, stop doing that.
Mm.
As you say, you know, they say, curiosity kills the cat. I say curiosity is actually what gives us opportunities in life. So from that perspective, how did you have somebody who encouraged you to do that? You just did it off your own bat and you went back and you gave these as ideas and suggestions?
You're right, because you can do things off your own bat, and I did, but if you don't have the support, someone can pull your head in really quickly. So it was Ralph. It was the guy who actually offered me the opportunity to apply for a role in the first place. As an early manager, and we were the same age. Actually, Ralph is younger, who just said, yep, I like it, you know. And I didn't have too much pushback because my colleagues were kind of looking for somebody to stand up and help out as well. And so I would bring back that information, and it made us all a better team, I'd like to think. But you do get those clashes, I suppose, but I didn't have them then. And I had the opportunity over that five-year period to work out of the Glenroy office as well for a little bit, and then ended up at the Blackburn office working on a magazine, which I think lasted 6 weeks, called U Magazine, the letter U. And it was meant to take on the Melbourne Weekly, and we were going to win the war, and it was going to be huge, and it didn't work out. And at that time, I got first time of three that I was poached to go to another newspaper group, the Melbourne Independent Newspaper Group, because they too had had a situation where they had a former owner, five-year non-compete had expired, set up a newspaper in opposition, took all the real estate ads. So somehow came back to them that you should speak to this guy, me, and they made me a great offer. You know, they made me a great offer, and at that time I was a bit frustrated about where things were going in management. So I went off and we had to get 90% of the real estate advertising that had been lost back within 3 months. So this is September 1999. And back in those days, my Septembers were quiet. Richmond wasn't playing finals. So, you know, I had to do something.
But Saturdays were okay.
Saturdays were okay. Anything was okay, actually. So I spent a lot of time on that project and we won it. We got the business back. The irony is that the organisation that had set up the new newspaper went into administration, was bailed out and then made an offer for the Melbourne Independent Newspaper Group. So I ended up working for the people I'd spent a bit of time trying to make life difficult for. Another good experience.
So who are your early inspirations then in media?
Yeah, look, at Leader, sad to say, probably not that many because it was a business that was quite transactional. Ralph, certainly early on. But it's funny, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan simply because when I got into leadership or started to feel that I could be in leadership professionally, I sought out inspirational people and I come across this guy called Vince Lombardi. I read a lot about Lombardi and it was, I look back now, it's pretty basic stuff. There's only one solution and that is winning, et cetera, et cetera. It really doesn't work in today. But it got me thinking that I need to seek out people like that, people who are a bit more upwardly or forward thinking. I looked at some real estate agents as mentors.
So can I go back one step there? Were you a Vince Lombardi fan because of what he achieved with the Packers, or were you a fan of his and as a result of that became a fan of the Packers?
That's right. It's that way. And the guy was a bit like Tommy Hafey. Didn't make it as a player.
Yeah.
But was an outstanding brain and understood.
He seemed to be an outstanding leader.
Yeah, he understood what it takes to get the best out of people. So that the early mentors were outside of the organisation. I would say John Piccolo, now Woodards, one of the founders of Woodards, then was the owner of a real estate agency called Paul Levy and Appel. John was a great support to me, and Paul Lenardi, Nelson Alexander. Paul even offered me an office. I could have been a real estate agent. Offered me a Pasco Vale office that they were opening up, and I caught up with him not that long ago. And he said, "You could have been a really rich man, Ag." And I said, "Well, but I'm probably richer than what I am now. I get it, but no, I'm okay. I made the right choice." But so it was those people because they, you think about the growth of those two organisations and real estate in general. The difference between Melbourne and Sydney real estate has always been that, in Sydney, Ray White in the Double Bay offices and big franchises, LJ Hooker, but Victoria was always the niche operator.
Mm.
Nelson's, Woodards, Barry Plant, what it became. But they've grown themselves, and it's because of those people that they've seen that vision this could grow, that we shouldn't just be an inner-city real estate agency. We can take this brand further out. So you're both still really good friends.
Okay. So if you go on to that, all of us young men at that time, and we don't necessarily know it at the time, but we have mentors. And it's when you look back now that you realise that person was such an inspiration or a personal mentor. What for you, basically you know everyone, that there is to know or required to know as well. And more importantly, you're actually extremely well liked by everyone as well who comes across you and knows you. Where in respect to have you had in respect to mentors for your business, for life in general? So who have been some of those mentors for you?
So in recent times, over the last 15 years, people like Greg Roebuck, founder of Car Sales. Greg not only has been a great supporter of my career, but I just like the way Greg thinks. One of the most humble millionaires going around.
You worked at Car Sales for 7 years?
7 years, 2013 to 20. It was Greg that got me over there. That was the second time I'd been poached. And I'd known Greg from when that business started.
Yeah.
I was at News and we're looking at this thing called Car Sales. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it's the internet. I wonder how that's going to go. But then I also had...
It's done okay.
I had a bit of a bumpy start, but it's done okay. But Greg was also a member at Richmond. So I knew Greg from that emceeing period as well. So we had a great relationship.
Is there okay people at Richmond?
There's some. We try our hardest. There's a great bunch actually at Richmond. But Greg definitely. Another guy called Michael Drapak. Michael Drapak Capital He owned a professional cycling team, employed my cousin, Agostino Giramondo, so two of us.
You made this name famous, though.
I was telling people that he's a great bike rider, but I'm smarter.
I remember when a colleague of mine, you commented on a post of mine, whether it be on Facebook or something, and the name Agostino Giramondo came up, and a colleague of mine, old triathlete, pro triathlete by name Rod Sodaro, said, Agostino, you won't remember this, but I was riding with you after this, and you said, sorry, Rod, that's my cousin Agostino Giramondo.
It happens less now.
Yeah.
It used to happen all the time, you know. When I joined Oz Cycling, it was even worse. But by then, people had understood that I was a different egg.
Giramondo apparel, bikes, everything.
Yeah, that had a great business. Giramondo Sportswear still exists in a small form, but it still exists. And then I would say, there is a person who was my advertising director when I was at the Herald Sun, who let me be me, and that's Fiona Mellor. Fiona's now at Harness Racing Victoria. Fiona was terrific because we worked great as a team. You know, she felt I was better at handling the internal operations, the people, etc., and that she was the person who was connected. And I understood that, and she understood that. But because of that, she took me along on her journey as well. So when I got the opportunity to move to Sydney to be the advertising director of the Telegraph, I was ready. And someone like Fiona was the first and strongest supporter of me moving, because she didn't see me as a deputy. She just saw me as the person who would have the same role as her, but somewhere else. So it's people like that. And more recently, Marnie Fechner, the CEO of Oz Cycling. I just have great admiration for a person that's taken on that role. Comes from Netball Australia, the first merged entity of sport, you know, BMX, Mountain Bike, Cycling Australia, defederated, greatest governance reform in Australian sport. It's one of the most compelling reasons why I ended up, you know, because it fit to work there for a short term. She is a magnificent CEO, a great leader of people, and a person who is, you know, I think we can all do this, who can say no.
Okay.
And that's a really important lesson, because you can't say yes to everything, and you can't be whatever
you
want to.
But if you can say no, we've created an enemy even better.
You talk about Facebook. I'm no longer on that platform, but yeah, that during that time, doesn't matter what decision you made, in sport it's very toxic. People always have an opinion. I do sneak a peek every morning. Cycling, but it happens everywhere. We think it's
exciting. Now, I remember you being, and especially with your surname, well, full name actually, Agostino Giramondo, so involved in, you know, you are a pure road cyclist and track as well. So you're probably the first person, male at St Bernard's, to ever shave his legs.
Started a trend.
Yeah, that's right. So you did. So it's... but I think when you actually look back, I remember you writing an article, it might have been on Facebook, about BMX and how BMX has grown. It might have been before the last Olympics. And my first thought process was, this is Agostino Giramondo, the road cyclist. The road cyclists had the best 10 speed, as we used to call them, back in secondary school. Now writing about BMX. And I just thought that I just saw that flip, because being a triathlete, roadies didn't like us. And, you know, we were colourful lycra. So it's
bars,
exactly right.
Being bunches,
they
still exist.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. So it's even worse, I think, with some of the mountain bikers. They're like the snowboarders who just don't like any of us.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It doesn't stop, right? There's always
exactly right. But I found your article unbelievably inclusive, really opening up my mind towards BMX. I remember having my mongoose in primary school, but opened up my mind towards BMX as actually being a real sport now.
Oh, it's an amazing sport, and I got to know more.
It came from a roadie writing this article.
Yeah.
Who happened to be, you know, at Cycling Australia now.
Yeah, so I was the president of the Brunswick Cycling Club for a little while, and we hatched this idea that it's going through. If anyone from Moreland Council is listening, please, we're going to prove it quickly. We hatched this plan to put a pump track in the middle of the velodrome. And one of the reasons for that is because I had understood by then that BMX is actually your first bike. Your first bike is a BMX.
It's the longest.
Yep. And the problem is that after BMX, because it's such a brutal sport, not many continue. So there was this perception that it was an entry-level sport and then you move into some other discipline. But actually there is a life after BMX, and there's an extension of your career in BMX. And it's only because we'd built it, you know, the system had been built where it's just really for juniors, that it was contained. If we could start putting it in an area like a velodrome, and you have on a Thursday night your motor pace, and then you've got kids in the middle on a BMX, they might want to try the track, and the trackies might want to try a BMX on a pump track in particular. Same thing for mountain bike. You know, we now have people like Brendan Johnson and Cam Ivory, or Australian champions of both mountain bike.
Cadell Evans.
Was originally mountain bike. Caleb Ewan.
Yeah.
You know, Robbie McEwen was a BMXer.
Yeah.
Ryan Bailey was a BMXer. Yeah. He was the fastest man in the world at one point. So it was there.
Yeah.
And it just required somebody to bring it out. And that was a position in at Brunswick that I took very seriously, the greatest honour I've ever had to be the president of that magnificent club. But we had a voice and people listened. So, you know, publishing articles like that was about trying to get everyone else to open their eyes because it's right there. And the sport will suffer if we don't bring it together. So I was a firm believer in that.
That's a good segue for me. You've been in leadership roles for 25 to 30 years now and in vastly different, you know, whether it's president of the football club, whether it's being chair of the Herald Sun Tour, I mean cycling and bikes in general have always been a passion. Your daughter rides or was riding. I don't know if she's still
riding. Yeah, she's still riding trips and drabs.
Yep. But you've got you've always been in these leadership roles in everything that you've done. You, whether it was school or whatever the case may be, you've always been in those leadership roles. So how is it going from, you know, being an inspiring leader? Because one of the things I've seen about you is that you're an inclusive leader. You're not a leader by do it my way and I'll yell and scream at you. You're actually, that's why you're always so well liked at school and everything after school as well. You've been this real inclusive leader. Where has that come from? Who have you learned that from? Is there something that's inbuilt in you? How do you get everyone from different opposing teams who are working under you to follow that same trajectory?
Firstly, thank you for that compliment.
And it's a genuine compliment.
Yeah, in as you get more senior and you have tougher decisions to make, sometimes you realise that not everybody will see it that way. But you have to be fair is the number one thing. Look, I subscribe to a theory of, you know, we're working together. One of my great inspirations, if I was to pick a person to have dinner with, is Alan Mulally, the former CEO of Boeing and Ford. You know, if you remember, Ford during the GFC didn't take any money, everyone else did. I don't know Alan Mulally, but he talks about having humility, love, and service. Humility in the way you operate. Love what you do, and you're in service. So that bit about being inclusive, I think the third term service is just the way I've always felt we should do things. It may have probably some of it came from Dad. My grandfather too, Mum's dad, he was the president of his Italian club and a very inclusive man too, a bit of a statesman, like he'd like to you know, represent himself that way too. But I remember coming home one day from school and there was this total stranger in my grandfather's house. And it turns out that he was visiting him because 3 weeks before, my grandfather had seen him at a service station, didn't know who he was. The guy was short of money and he gave him $15 or something like that. And the guy said, can I have your address? And, you know, Nonal gave it to him, never thinking he'd come back, but he, you know, came back to repay it. So I just think it's the right thing to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you've made mistakes and you could have done something differently. But the people that I've had as mentors all operate the same way.
You still had to make hard decisions.
Yeah.
You still had to lay people off. You still had to, you know, make those hard decisions as well. So it's not just getting everyone to like you. You've still had to, here's what we have to do for the business.
Yeah, but you still have to treat everybody with great respect when you do it. And sometimes it's difficult to come across that way because it's quite harsh. But, you know, decisions in general just change. You know, the job I've got now came in and changed some things. The business wasn't failing, but I predicted, made some assumptions that, you know, we'd had a COVID bump and there were some things that aren't going to be sustainable in the future. So taking the team through that change, you just can't do it. You can't be a velvet sledgehammer. You can't be a Matty Lloyd.
Yeah.
But you can't be you have to be genuine. And so, look, this is where I think we need to go. Get some buy-in around what that looks like. When we talk about terms like purpose, you don't make up the purpose or the culture? That's your team that helps you decide what that is.
Well, where does that, I mean, if we segue that into the media landscape and social media, and, you know, there's a bit of a battle going on between Meta and the normal mainstream media, or the print media.
Meta and everyone.
Yeah, the whole world, actually. That's true. So where in Agostino's game plan does it look like, you know, moving forward with that wonderful thing that seems to have taken off called the internet and social media, et cetera, and a traditional media landscape? Where does Agostino see that future moving forward for media?
It's a really good question, and I have thought about this, not with this particular issue, but even when you use the word traditional media, you know, 30 years, it causes you to reflect. I reckon 20 of those years have been in a digital business, to be honest. I mean, we've been digital for ages. We migrated our death and funeral notices mid-2000s over to the internet, not because we put them on the internet, but on the internet people could share it, could put in comments, could add photos, could speak to family. So that connectivity around the internet was there. And, you know, as a news organisation, I think we do a really good job of it. To the specific question about Meta, we've obviously got people who are in charge of our business and all the other publishers who are having this conversation now. But it generally goes along the lines of that, yes, there is, we believe that they should be paying for content, of course. They're making money out of it. But there's a broader issue here.
Yep.
The broader issue is, if you don't have news on these platforms, what do you get? It's misinformation. They don't do anything to patrol it. What happens to smaller publishers? What happens to budding journalists? So these are the big issues that need to be handled. So my first thought is that I don't think it's over, that conversation. I would like to see Meta come back to the table. I understand the government can put in their, they can enact their bargaining code, which, you know, means that publishers put a bid in on what they think the fair price is, so did platforms, and the regulator chooses which one. That's not negotiation. If you think about everything else in your life, you think about the inclusivity, you think about being fair, that comes from negotiation. It doesn't come from being partisan, it comes from being bipartisan. It comes from understanding everyone's angle. We have to understand that Google, Facebook, they're massive, massive businesses, Meta, sorry. They're huge businesses, so they have their own interests to protect and their shareholders. So, you know, we can argue and negotiate. Or we can just say, look, it's all too hard. So my view is that it's still a negotiating position, and hopefully that's where they come to. And that's my position on most things. Sometimes you have to make a call and you've got to drift. We're already doing that. I mean, in Canada, they just don't publish news on Facebook anymore, and it's really hurt society. Forget about the industry. It's hurt society. There is misinformation rife in Canada. And that's something we've got to try and avoid here. And when you work for a big organisation, it seems like you're just saying that because, you know, you're only protecting your own interests. And you are always going to protect your own interests. But our interests actually are journalism and a model that creates opportunity. We employ people. Now, Greg used to say this at car sales: I want your kids to work in our organisation. You know, I want you to be proud of where you work. I'm proud of where I work. We don't always agree on direction and editorial content. Well, who cares?
Yeah.
They're employers of Australians, right? And this affects companies that employ Australians. So we have to care about it.
But I think, too, when you've got what you do in the media, you know, working with News Corp at the moment, and but what the mainstream media does, if you have a look at it, doesn't matter whether you're taking, for example, and people can talk about an interview, say, of Piers Morgan or on CNN or whoever. But basically, you got 7 minutes and he's going to throw a Dorothy Dixer at you to get you off, you know, to try and unnerve you in a way, and because that's what actually gets the clicks. And then you have, on social media, you have a seven-second clip, which that clip is totally taken out of context if you listened to the entire interview, or you have on Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter, what's that, 140 characters or something. So basically you can't get that across, whereas you guys provide a story, something to read. Now, I subscribe online. I don't buy the physical newspaper anymore, but I subscribe online because I like to read the story, not just get a 7-second soundbite.
Mm.
My mother will still buy the Herald Sun. Every day she buys the Herald Sun and then she reads it and then she gives it to her cafe where she has her coffee and she gives it to them.
Right.
So, but she still likes the physical newspaper. Oh, she'll take out, you know, some of the sections and take that but just leave. She never reads the sports section, which Herald Sun was actually quite famously known for.
Yeah, yeah, still is.
Yeah, she won't read the sports section, but she reads everything else. Even though, unless there's 5 pages of the Bombers, that's all she'll care about.
Yeah, which will happen mid-year when there's a bit of a collapse. Anyway, we won't go there. Look, I think...
I sadly think he might be.
Who knows? I could be wrong on this one. Yeah. They're going to turn the corner at some point. But the... See, even that, if I just put you up on the print versus digital, which is create content, and it's accessible over different platforms. And we use social. And that 7-second bite, that 140 characters, we use that. We use that to get people's attention. This might be something you like. And we ask people to subscribe because you should be paying for something that someone has spent some time creating. So we don't.
And you have to still pay that journalist. And you've still got overheads to pay. And somebody who actually creates content and actually just puts it on social media, who is not getting paid, the only way they can actually survive is if they do have clickbaits through to some form of advertising. If there's not a form of advertising there or clickbait, they're not really going to get paid.
Yeah, and sadly, that doesn't always work out that way for them, but it works out great for the platform.
Yeah.
Because they're selling attention.
Well, our podcast has nothing to do with, we never talk about our own product on our podcast. We actually just interview really interesting people for all of our clients and other people. We don't advertise. We don't make any money off it. For us, it's an information service. But if this was our job, well, I'd be living on the street.
Yeah. And so you can understand why the model is, if you're selling attention, then you do everything you can to make sure there are no interruptions to that. So I get it.
Mm.
I get it. So we're bring the argument back to what is important here, right? Not about understanding everyone's business model. It fundamentally, it's a society question. What sort of society do we want? We want one where there is freedom of speech and freedom of press. And you're going to have organisations that lean one way or the other. You're just going to. That's normal, right? One thing about print, I will say, though, is that when we put something out in the printed environment, any organisation, it's got to be factual, can't be slanderous. We live in a litigious society, and you see there aren't that many lawsuits, right? So there's a lot of time spent on that. You can't retract that. Online you can change.
Less lawsuits now that Joe Aston's retired.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I love you, Joe.
I want to be in that.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
But even that, like you'd think there might be, but it's very carefully written.
Absolutely.
Now, you need resources for that. You need to train people. So the money that we've been getting as publishers has gone into training journalists, retaining journalists, and the smaller publications are the ones that have benefited. You know, we've set up with Google the News Digital Academy to train journalists to be better digital journalists. So it's been really beneficial for the economy. For the economy of news. It's a big organisation. We're a big business. It's a big industry, and it's an important one.
I was at a breakfast the other morning where Julia Gillard was the guest, mm-hmm. Guest speaker there. And, you know, I've often said that I didn't necessarily think much of her as a prime minister, but I also thought she was, you know, she wasn't fairly treated, mm-hmm. Especially by her own party and certain individuals or ex-prime ministers in her own party in particular. But at the same time, she's probably been the greatest retired prime minister that we've had, where she's just kept out of it and just got on and done, tried to do good for the world and society in general. But one of the things that she stated regarding social media and the media was she would not read anything on social media when she was prime minister. Some of the vile comments that were made. So how she made the comment how somebody on social media can say, "I'm going to rape and murder you. You know, you female dog." I'll try not to swear on a podcast. But if that was wanted as a full-page ad in the Herald Sun, there's no way known that would get printed. So as much as you can have free speech, where does it get to the point where if you're not prepared to say it into somebody's face, how can that be allowed in respect to, so, and there is that fine line of free speech and just being absolutely vile. But then there's also what one person perceives as vile, another person can perceive as a laugh.
Yeah.
As well. But when it's a personal attack like that, if I make a comment on social media, I at least try to make it factual, you know, not personal.
Yeah, and, you know, the emotions get better if people sometimes we get that. But that
I've just been banned from commenting on social media, just as the easiest thing.
Is that a ban or is it?
No, probably a bit of both. So it's, but as Jamie in here says, I was never on Twitter when it was called Twitter, and I got on Twitter because I just wanted to see all these comments Donald Trump has made, and we've been 3 minutes, we had our marketing head, and Jay, you're on Twitter. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. We know you are. So we're in 3 minutes. You're not allowed to make any comments. You're allowed to observe no comments. And but it was
saying that to Donald Trump, by the way.
Yes, that's right. But I think though the thing is that, as Jamie said, why are you arguing with Karen from Minnesota, you know, about something? So you might be factually correct, but who cares? You know, so why is that taking up your bandwidth? And I think that's actually more the point, is that
it's a human emotion, though, isn't it? Like, I've tried all of them. You know, X, Facebook. So I can't say I hate them. I'll never go on them. I've been on them.
Yeah.
I'm still on Instagram because it helps me stay connected with young cyclists that are overseas that I've seen grow up, and they're often posting pictures. Some of them are just, you know, here I am doing up my shoes. But they're, you know, so and so's racing over in Europe now. Great, right?
Great promotion of their sponsor of that shoe.
No, and I get it. They've got an obligation to that. So I'm not anti-social media. But every human being has got a tolerance point. So, you know, if you hear things are said about you and you go and refer to them and you read it, you know, I can understand why people feel compelled to respond. There's an inner strength that says don't. And you know, I found this out during the cycling time. I just don't. But, you know, I think you've got governments that might come in and intervene here, but then you've got to be careful because that could be an intervention that is actually prohibiting freedoms that you should have. So it's a delicate one, and I don't have the answer, but some sort of moderation. And if you go back to prior to, you know, the neoliberalism, so prior to capitalism version one, there was a lot more regulation. And the world prospered. So, you know, maybe going back to something like that where it's not over-regulated, but that we could be getting too deep if we have that conversation. But it is a really difficult one.
In secondary school, we just grew up with schoolyard regulation.
But that was it. I'm self-moderated.
Very self-moderated. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything. Even if I disagree with him, I don't want to punch him in the face. I'm not going to be rude.
But just say there is something said between two people.
Yeah.
In 1986, in 1984, in 1982. Yeah. Someone may have witnessed it and they would have said, I heard this. But that now becomes viral.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, I do feel, I don't have sympathy for people dropping milk on the top of a bridge onto a boat, et cetera, but you do have, you know, kids, right? So you've got to have some, if you just put in rules, it's not going to cater for everybody. So, it is a delicate one. But I'll tell you what, there's also this age that we're in now. So my daughter's 18. She was born 2005. That's the social media age.
Yeah.
Right? I was listening to a very interesting podcast, Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN. I'm not a huge CNN fan. I'm ambivalent, but I don't mind his stuff. He did a six-part series on social media, and he had his daughters throughout the series. And at the end, in the last episode, he asked two questions of his eldest daughter. And he asked her two questions. Do you think we let you onto social media too early? And the answer was yes. Would you do the same with your children? The answer was no. So I think there's going to be a bit of regulation that comes from the next generation of family makers because we didn't have a playbook. It's a bit like COVID. We didn't have a playbook. And we've all done it. Like I said before, I've done it. We get onto social. And in 2017, I was posting every week. Every Richmond victory, I was going okay, thanks.
Don't I remember.
Yeah. So, you know, so you're grateful I'm off it, right? But there were times.
And as a youth, the Premiership Cup, can you actually? You're going to Arcadia. How many photos could the two of you have on there for the Premiership Cup?
The answer is not enough. But it does get also very expensive being a Richmond supporter, so much memorabilia, you know, three times. You know, it's hard, right? So we're taking a break at the moment. It's good for the hip pocket. In all honesty, there was an incident there, and I won't name names, that a friend of mine made a comment about we'd beaten Essendon, and I said, good to beat the Bombers again. And, she commented, I know you don't like Essendon. And someone else jumped in, and they ended up having an argument, and they're total strangers. And I had to jump in and go, whoa, everyone just relax, right? This is all a bit of fun. So that was my
bit of fun, and we know Richmond are the best.
I could have done that. It would have just
antagonised a little bit.
Well, I was taken aback by the whole, my goodness, this has gone too far, right? And that's what happens. That's what happens with social media. So, if we think about, we've got a whole generation. They always say that Facebook is for the over 50s, but that's also as over 50s, we always try and keep up with. The next trend, even though we get it second, like now we're not on Snapchat, et cetera.
I'm 54 and I first joined Facebook because my sister was sick to death of me asking, what are my kids up to? She said, can you just join and stalk them yourself if that's okay, rather than me actually telling you, and that's why I joined it. But I also think too that a lot of actual people our age joined Facebook because they were going through divorces. And it was a way of meeting members of the opposite sex through things like Tinder and all the rest of it. That's why you're not on Facebook. So, Jordan, so you don't need to be. So happily married to Lisa.
Stay off it.
Yeah.
We know that people go through various life stages and are attracted to certain things.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, you reminded me of my speech at our 30-year reunion,
It was very true, and I told you about that, and it's something that I've actually reiterated to many people. The 10-year reunion, our 10-year reunion was, we were basically all still trying to live our glory days. We're just 28 now rather than 18, and our 20-year reunion, we're all miserable, divorced, and just not enjoying life whatsoever, and a mortgage and having to start again, and our 30-year reunion, we just didn't care anymore. So it was, and we're 2 years away from our 40-year reunion.
Yeah, I'm working on that speech now. Good. But it's true because we go through different stages and then we feel differently. So, social media's just allowed us to express those feelings to more people, and that's quite dangerous because the human being is not built to have that many relationships. There is science behind this. I won't quote it because I don't know it, but,
I don't know the numbers, but I know the science you're
referring to. Yeah, yeah. So, all of that means that there could be a bit of a change. And if you go back to how media is consumed, that's changed forever. But is there a printed product in the future? Probably. I don't know what it looks like. It's certainly not every day. I think that's becoming more and more obvious. But what happens digitally changes as well. What are we actually giving our subscribers? Is there more bundling? Is there, is the Apple News model where you go, where you can subscribe to a number of different things and you can go in and out? It's happening with streaming now. You used to have a different set-top box and that changed, and now Hubble's come out, which is magnificent, by the way. I bought a Hubble the other day and you've got everything on there. Well, whoever they've got a partnership with, and that'll keep growing. So things evolve. I mean, no one knows what the world looks like in 2 years. It used to be 5 years.
Mm.
But it will be different.
Yeah.
And you have to change before you're forced to.
And that's where I think someone like yourself, you have that mindset. I'm not saying, this is the way we've always done it, so it's how we're going to continue to do it. But if I can close on this question, I said this earlier, you are one of the most connected people that I know. You've done that, though, by virtue of being a person who people like to know and to be around. You as a young kid, you're the MC of the Richmond Football Club as well. So you are very well connected. But where do you see, I suppose looking through a lens of your current employment and things like that as well, where do you see moving forward those sort of connections and where that leads you into the future and in respect to your roles and having, and it's a very long question, sorry, Ag, but having that diversity of friendships and very, very strong business relationships as well, where does that lead you in respect to being able to say, here's where I think life is going in respect to wherever things are moving, here's how I think we should be manoeuvring the newspaper or things like that. Where does Agostino see, as of things today, the next few years, say in this wonderful state of ours being Victoria?
It's It's a great question and one that...
So you know everyone from both sides of politics, both sides of the spectrum, both sides of business, you know, so there's a lot of people you know and are very well connected with.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's always more people you'd like to know and connect with, but it's a good spread. And look, I love a quote from Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, that the job you're currently doing is the only job you should worry about, right? Because you invest everything in it. And you think of the opportunities that are brought up every day. So a year and a bit ago, if you'd told me I'd be working as a GM of News Corp Rural and I'd be looking after the agriculture space, I would have said, no way, I've got no idea about agriculture. And I don't. But understanding that business has helped open up even more connections. You know, the unbelievable economy in farmland property, the ag tech industry, etc. So I just think the next 2 years are the same as the next 20 years.
Another St. Bernard's family, very successful, the Faleys.
Yeah, the Faleys, exactly. So, that, you know, there are so many connections that you didn't realise existed. But even with horses, with racehorses, you know, obviously.
Laundries.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people in the country who are, you know, clearly trainers and.
Well, Jim Troy Podarsky.
Yeah. So you know, we went to school with all these people, the McQuiggies. Yep. You know, so all of these people, there's a connection there. And you come in and out. Greg Cattrell's at, in the industrial space in agriculture with BASF and others. And, you know, your paths cross, right? So I think the next 2 years is the same as the next 20 or however long life is. And that is that opportunities will present themselves and you assess them and you work out if it's right for you. Like I said, I would have thought that I had this opportunity, but I now know that the agriculture industry it feeds Australia and 78% or whatever is exported internationally. That's an amazing stat and farmers are hard done by and they need to be supported. But what we do at News can be replicated across what we do at the Weekly Times. You know, we've got advocacy platforms, the Farmer of the Year, the Shine Awards celebrating women in agriculture. We've got Future Victoria. So from a Victorian sense, there's absolutely a lot of synergies. And, you know, I love the Herald Sun, always have. It's where I, you know, started to make an impression in my career. And it's always been a very special organisation, very special publication. So sitting in the Herald Sun meetings is a great honour too. So, yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Sino, I'm looking forward to, in a couple of years' time, having another podcast with you. You can be what we call a repeat offender and say, here's what we said. We said, who knows? Here's what's happened
over
the next 2 years. So thank you very much for agreeing to be one of our special guests today. We sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
The Coffin Bond Podcast is a product from Coffin Bond & Co., which we are an authorised representative of Gann Financial. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal or tax advice. The hosts of the Coffin Bond Podcast are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decision, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from the podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Coffin Bond website, or you can find resources on the ASIC website and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Coffin Bond and Co. and the host of the Coffin Bond podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.